Okay, good morning, everybody. Good to see you all. Today's Daf Shavua is sponsored by Michael Yael Schreiber in memory of Michael's grandmother, Sadie Schreiber, Sarah Bat Zacharia, Aleha Shalom, and Hashem Havin Aleha, are learning it in her memory. Indeed. Apologies for the timing. Our hope today, I've given you staple two sheets, because why not use technology when you can? And I'm afraid it is not printed in a way that each page is a daf. You've got your Gimel Amud Bet on the front, and then onto your Dalet, and then your Dalet Amud Bet onto Tet Vav, which I know is more than just one daf. It is my intention to get through to the end of the Perek today for a couple of reasons. Number one, so that we can kind of finish topically in an appropriate juncture. Also, next Sunday, I'm not going to be able to be here for the Duff. So, I feel the pain.
Michael will do it in your stead.
Okay, good. That's what I was thinking. I'll sponsor. If that's going to happen, I'll sponsor the breakfast. Don't hold me to that, and don't hold him to that.
You're not going
to
get your money for it.
Yeah, I'm sure I will. Let's push ahead. And finishing the Perek, it's worth noting the subjects we've covered since the start, not just kind of to rush through, but we had the first opening Mishnah, which was when do we start saying Mashiv HaRuach, and we're going to end with a messianic note about how we may fare in the future. And the trajectory from there to here, bless you, has taken us through discussions of the meaning of prayer from the very first page, where we spoke about what is Avodah Shevalev, what is the service of the heart, what is the point of Mashiv HaRuach, is it just a rote liturgy that's routine, or is this a way of connecting with God in a sincere way? And we had that theme repeat in waves as we went through. We had a discussion of how appropriate it is to test God, the three figures in history who say, God, if you do this for me, I'll do something for you, and whether that's appropriate or not, which also plays with this question of, is prayer a sincere way to connect to God? So if it is, then why not test God? Meaning, if I'm really trying to connect, when I say you do, I'll make a deal with you. Or is that inappropriate? Are there lines? Are there not lines? And we're going to also touch on that today in the Daf. At what point does prayer become an abuse of religion? So we'll come to that as well. We then had a second mission. We spoke about dew and clouds and whether things that we rely on all the time should be part of our prayer, or can we rely that there are standard things in life that we don't have to worry about God's involvement with. Rain seems to stand out as the example of something that is relatively routine, but is somewhat precarious enough for us to read providence into it. If it doesn't, meaning there's no dew in the morning, that's not God, that's we've ruined the planet and we better panic. If there's no rain in the morning, that's God, because it is precarious enough that God intervenes with it, and we are dependent enough on it that it would be kind of the place where God would go to draw our attention to internal failures, which led us to the next Mishnah, which essentially just says, when do we stop saying V'tein Talamatar? But again, if we were just doing the Mishnah, and we did the five Mishnayot of Perek Aleph, it would be rapid, it would be technical. When do I say Mashiv HaRuach? When do I stop saying V'tein Talamatar? When do I stop V'tein Talamatar? What happens if it hasn't rained by this date? Some fasts, how many fasts, who fasts? And then the last mission would be, and if those aren't answered, what do we do then? Okay, so we stop doing some work and we act kind of like Tisha B'Av. Second Perek. And what the Gemara, what Chazal do is they slow us right down and they say, this is not just a technical document about what you say, when you say, and how you progress through the calendar. But there are themes here that we should reflect upon that deepen this discussion. And I tried to sit down and isolate over the last 14 daf kind of things that have come up. We've spoken about whether nizirut is a sin, whether to mark yourself as, I'm going to live a more pious life. Is that problematic? Is fasting when you don't need to, is that a sin? We had discussions along those lines. How great is rain? Is it as great as creation? Why may it not rain? Because of Lashon Hara, because you don't do Truma Maaseh, because the world is falling apart. And we've had discussions about theodicy. If people are suffering and everything really is connected to God, can I connect people's suffering to errors on their part, which we resolved as well. We spoke about the tension between the self and community. What happens if I'm doing okay, but everybody else is going bankrupt? Can I just enjoy myself, or do I have to live a restrained life? Or should I see it as God giving me preferential treatment, and to live a restrained life would be a betrayal of what God wants of me? How do I struggle with my place in the community? And last time we spoke about, as we hit the last Mishnah and the last resort, is this the same as grief? Is there a difference between grief, I've lost something that is irreparable, or when we're in trouble, is there always hope? And actually, when I don't wash and when I'm not working, is that a way of essentially cutting myself off from the world and becoming isolated and forlorn? Or is this a strategic way to draw God back? And the metaphor I've been giving is about, you know, personal relationships, and I've unfortunately for Miriam been using her and myself as an example. But like, is there a point at which I say, you know, the relationship is done, and I may walk around in a state of complete despair? Is that just appropriate because something's been lost? Or is that a way to kind of get things going again? And that's where we are theologically with God at this point. It hasn't rained for weeks. We've now hit the last resort. We've fasted, we've had the elite fast, we've had the common people fast, we've done it three times, and then another three times, nothing. So now we have these seven fasts, which are all-encompassing, which include Shiva, Tisha B'Av behavior, which is, I'm not wearing shoes, I'm not working, I'm not washing, I'm not eating, I'm not drinking. At this point, are we just, and we'll get to today, in the last fast, there's Truah. And the Gemara is going to discuss, what does it mean to be Matria? Which essentially will come down to a form of primal scream. It will either be the scream of the shofar or the scream of liturgy, but it's going to be a form of screaming. And are we screaming because we're forlorn and this is done, and this is just the appropriate way to behave when God has abandoned us? Or are we screaming because we want help and we want you to come back? And that, where are we directing our energy? We're going to have no communication, no she'ilat shalom, like on Tisha B'Av. Now again, is that because I'm so despondent that I've just withdrawn into myself? Or is this a way to say, I'm not talking to you and I'm going on like a speech strike? So that's going to be part of what we'll discuss over the daf today. And there are essentially two themes that we'll weave together at the end as we cover this daf in particular, which is one that we've mentioned a few times. Is it ever appropriate to give up religiously? If I don't find God in my life, is there ever a point at which I should give up and I should move on and recognize that God isn't answering me here and that's it? Or is there always hope? And we're going to come to that in a couple of different instances. That's one theme. And the second theme is there ever a private crisis in my life that can amount to the same as a communal crisis? We've been talking about if there's no rain, that's not really a personal crisis, that's a communal crisis. What if there's something in my life that I feel plagued by God, and I want to fast, and I want to react? Is it ever appropriate for me to feel like the relationship I have with God is on par with the relationship God has with the community? And that will manifest halachically if I want to do a fast day, and I want to do a ta'anit tzibur, a public fast day, but it's just for me. Does that even cohere as a concept? I'm going to say the proper davening that you would say on a public fast day. I'm going to behave like it's a public fast day, but it's just for me. Or is that somehow hubris to think that, well, this is worthy of a public fast day because it's just me. And if I conclude that I'm not the equivalent of the community, does that mean I don't really have a relationship with God unless I'm part with other people? So we've got that tension to work through. Let's begin. Yud Gimel Amud Bet in the middle in the yellow, where the Mishnah was discussing all the things that we do on these last resort fast days. We don't wash, we don't eat, we don't drink, we don't wear shoes. And now the Gemara brings up something that does not come up in the Mishnah, but it will come up in the next perek. And this is strategic in some ways of Chazal to kind of get us thinking about subjects that they'll note in a minute and say, well, this is going to come up in the next perek, and to kind of keep us going. Tzluta de Tanita Heichemad Karinan. What about the special insert for prayer for fast days? Where do you say it? What's the insert for prayer day, for fast days rather? Anenu. So where do I say Anenu is fundamentally the question. Adabre Rav Yehuda Rav Yitzchak Bre. Rav Yehuda was walking around with his son Rav Yitzchak, his Udrash, and he was speaking, he was expounding. Yachid Shikibla Lav Tanit Mipala Shal Tanit says a single person, individual person, who accepts a fast on themselves, they should daven Anenu. They should say the prayer of fast days. V'heichan omra, and when should they say it? Ben goel l'rofe. They should say it as a separate bracha, like the Chazan does on a fast day. between those two brachot of Goel Yisrael and Rofech Olam. Matkif la Rav Yitzchak, his son asked him and said, hold on a minute. You're telling me, and this is part of that theme, can I ever have a personal crisis that amounts to the same as a communal crisis? He says, you're telling me that an individual can say, right, tomorrow I'm feeling betrayed, I'm feeling abandoned, I need to reach out to God, I'm going to do my own fast, and I'm going to say Aneinu as a bracha on its own. And he's saying, you're telling me an individual can just say their own bracha like as if they're a community of one? What are you talking about? Elam Rav Yitzchak b'shemeh tefillah. No, you have to insert that in shemeh tefillah. And shemeh tefillah, if you use the art scroll, I don't know if other books have this, but they'll have like a little asterisk right before it says ki el towards the end of the bracha, and they'll say, if you've got a personal prayer, insert it here. And sometimes that works if you've forgotten something early in Amidah, you can insert it there. And if you've got a personal prayer, some people try to insert something mentally in Rofeh, in Refuah, in the bracha of Refuah, and some people try to reserve it here. And there's a question now, can I say, and this is what we put Aneinu, what else do we put in Shema Tefillah, or Shema Koleinu? One other time we put something in there. Tisha B'Av, it's like the acceleration of an average fast day, we put Nachem there. So that's where we've got like these personal prayers, where we say it on our own. So that's where Rav Yitzchak says Aneinu should be, which is what we do on a fast day as individuals. We don't say it between Goel and Rafa, which is extremely odd, because usually the Chazan essentially repeats whatever we do in the private Amidah. And in many ways, the private Amidah is seen by the commentators as all designed just for practice for Chazan. We all do our own thing so that when the Chazan goes, he's had a chance to go through the material before he has to do it on behalf of the community. So the fact that it would be different when he's doing it publicly than when we all do it privately is a cause for question. The Rav Sheshes and Rav Yitzchak says, and it's not just me, Dad, who says that you should say it on Shmei Tefillah, but also Rav Sheshes say that. Now in the next 15 lines, there's going to be a back and forth which has some very important premises taken for granted. How many brachot are in the Shemona Esrei? Excellent. 18 or 19, depending on when you're counting. So it's either one of those two. It turns out there are occasions when there are not 18 or 19. Some of them we still have today. When are there not 18 or 19 brachot in the Shemona Esrei? Shabbat, Yom Tov. How many on Shabbat? There are seven. How many on Yom Tov? Five. It depends on the Yom Kippur. There are more. It depends. Six, depending on the occasion. So it turns out, what is the maximum number of brachot you can have? 20? When's that?
When you add
Aneinu. When you're the Shlich Tzibur and you add Aneinu. So it turns out that's probably the case today. It used to be a case that you could have 24. And this is the first Mishnah of the next Perek, that there would be 24 brachot with six extra ones for a crazy fast day. We don't practice that anymore. But it's taken for granted that in these extreme fasts, there are 24 brachot said by the Chazan, not privately. So that's an important premise as we go forward, because he's now going to say, hold on a minute. Rav Yitzchak manages to go against his father and say, you have to say it privately. You can't have your own brachot. There's only 18 if you are accepting a fast on your own. Meitfei, we've got a brighter that says, hold on a minute. Ein ben yachid letzibur. There is no difference between an individual person and the community in terms of a fast day. Elet shezemit pala shmona esrei, zemit pala tshasrei. Apart from this one does 18 brachot and this does 19 brachot. So what does that sound like? No difference between a yachid and a tzibur. What's a yachid, an individual? What's a tzibur? What are we referring to? The chazan. Is that what we're referring to? That's what it sounds like. And now he's going to suggest that's not the case. Because how many brachot does the Chazan say on an extreme fast day? 20, or in the most extreme, the Gemara is now going to presume this, 24. So it can't be referring to the Chazan saying 19. Because he wouldn't say 19, he'd be saying 24. So the Yachid and Sibur must mean something else. And it suggests maybe it means a Yachid who accepts a Yachid fast day, or a Yachid who accepts a Tzibur fast day. Which would mean a yachid who accepts a communal fast day on their own would say 19 brachot, meaning they do have their own brachot. That's kind of the complex Mishnah proof here to suggest that Rav Yitzchak is wrong and his dad was right, and a yachid can make their own brachot and be a community of one, be a tzibur on their own.
Are they just
say again?
Are they talking about just at mincha?
During Shacharit as well.
Shacharit as well.
Yeah. So let's see how this goes. My yachid and my tzibur. Before we can use this as a proof, the Gemara says, what does yachid and tzibur mean in this context? First word on the line is ilema, about six thin lines up. Ilema yachid mamash, if we suggest that this means that the Yachid on his own does, or her own does, 18. V'tzibur shlich tzibur, and the community, that refers to the representative. Hanichasre esrim varbahavu. Why would he only be doing 19? The shlich tzibur would be doing 24. El alav, no, it must mean hachi, kamas mean as follows. Ein ben yachid, he will have tanit yachid, le yachid will have tanit tzibur. Must say, oh, if an individual accepts a yachid fast, they do 18. If they accept a communal fast, they do 19. What does that prove? First word online, the acronym Shmamina. Shmamina, Yachid Kovea Bracha La'atzma. So, Rav Yitzchak, you're wrong. It sounds like a Yachid who accepts a public fast day can do a Bracha on their own because they end up doing 19. Lo! Rav Yitzchak, or the Gemara on his behalf, says, no, that's not how you should read that. La'ulam, Eim Lach Shleik Tzibur. We should go back to our original presumption. This is talking about an individual in the community and the Shleik Tzibur. One does 18 and one does 19, as we do all the time. What happened to the thought that they do 24, the Shlech Tzibur? Dukakashlach, Shlech Tzibur, Esrim Va'arba Matzle. In the fact that you think that there are 24 brachot for the Shlech Tzibur, Begimol, Taniot, Rishon, no. This is talking about the first three. Now, the pattern was we do three emergency fasts, then we do another three, then we do seven. So the assumption is in the first three, you don't have these 24 brachot. So that's what this Mishnah is talking about. Deleka, Esrim Va'arba. There's not 24, so the Mishnah now works perfectly well. You've got somebody accepting a communal fast day, and on those days, the Shlech Tzibur says 19. Velo, hold on a minute. You're telling me there aren't 24 brachot on the first three kind of fast days. Vaha ein bein tani. It says ein bein in the following brighter, talking about the different stages of fast. Ein bein gimel shon le gimel amtsiot. There is no difference between the first three and the middle three. Apart from on the first you can do work, and on the second group you can't do work. That sounds like everything else is the same. Liturgically, they should be the equivalent. And every communal fast day should have 24 brachot for the Shlech Tzibur, which would mean, again, going back to our central question here. The central question is, if I'm an individual, when do I say Anenu? If I accept a fast day, is it possible I say it on my own, ben goa l'rofe? And we're now trying to find, is there any possible case where we would allow an individual to say their own bracha? So we're going back and forth, and there's one Mishnah that sounds like maybe a Yachid can accept a communal fast day on their own and say their own bracha. So we're now having a pushback to say, that is not possible. And we're trying to figure out whether there are 24 blessings on every communal fast day, or only on the middle three, or the last seven, and not the first three. But there is a brighter. This is the second wider line. Ein bein gimel rishonu legimel amtsiot. There is no difference between the first three and the middle three, apart from one you can do work and one you can't. But that sounds like 24 brachot are equal on both. Fourth line, tana v'shayer. Now this is an interesting technique or strategy on the part of the sage. You say, oh, it's not comprehensive. That ein bein says there's no difference between the first fast and the middle fast, apart from on one you can work and one you can't. Sounds like that's the only difference between them. The Gemara says, Tana v'shayer, it taught, but it left stuff out. There are other differences. And the Gemara is going to in a minute say, well, hold on, ein bein means there's no difference apart from this, but you're telling me there are other differences? So it says, my shayer dehai shayer. What else is left out that they're going to leave this out? What makes this so special that it's going to leave out the major difference liturgically? The one is 18 and one is 24. The two, and never mind, conceptually, that's an odd thing to do, to leave out one detail. Ha ein bein tani, it says there is no difference. It seems pretty stressful on that point. Ela tana, but no, what it's talking about is b'asure kamayri. It's only talking about the differences in prohibitions, but filot lamayri is not talking about prayer. And this is an important distinction to suggest that prayer is in a different mode than prohibitions. It could be that prohibition is about cultivating a sense of despair on one's own, and prayer is about reaching out to God. They're all part of the same mode. That's why we might have resistance to divide them up. But now, conceptually, we're open to them not being in the same teaching. V'bayit ema. Alternatively, you could say, maybe there are only 24 brachot on the last seven. And that ein bein is literal. There is no difference between the middle and the first ones, apart from the working issue. And the chavdalit issue is the same as well. And there are no 24 brachot on the middle fast. Velo, but surely there are 24 brachot on the middle fast. Vatana, it was taught in another brighter. Ein bein shalosh shneiot the sheva acharonot. There is no difference between the middle three and the last seven. Elishabelu matrin v'nolit nechareyut. Apart from on the last ones, we call out and we lock the shots. Halachot devarim zev zeh shavin. It sounds like everything else they should be same, including the number of brachot in the Amidah. V'chitem ha'chenam in tana v'shayin. If you're going to tell me, oh no, here they also left out that detail, that's not important. Ha'ein bein tani. It says ein bein. It says there's no difference. Now the Gemara is saying, this whole argument that Ein Bein is literal is going to have to come apart. The Tisbara, does it make sense to you, Ein Bein Dafka, that it literally means there's no difference between these first fast and middle fast and middle fast and last fast, onto your Dalet Dalet Aleph? Vashai Teva, but it left out the Teva. What's the Teva? Right, it could either be what Moshe's in, what the animals are in, but in rabbinic language, Teva is the Aron Kodesh. And here, again, this is taken for granted, something's going to come up in the next parak, that part of these major fasts, the Aron Kodesh would be taken out of the shul, put into the street, ashes would be put on top of it, and they'd have a public demonstration with the ark, which is why it's helpful to have one on wheels. In addition, so it's saying, and that's not mentioned anywhere in this Mishnah, in this brighter that says, Ein Bein, there is no difference between this middle fast and last fast, apart from one you lock the stores and one you don't. And then we said, so presumably it has to have the same number of rachot and amidah. Said, no, it missed that out. Said, you can't miss that out. It doesn't miss anything out. Well, it missed out the teva. On the last seven fasts, you take out the ark. It doesn't say anything about that. Imashum teva lav shiurahu, the Gemara says, no, that is fundamentally a different subject, which might not be included and should be in the next parak. Mili de tzivik tani, because it's talking about what do we do privately. Mili freheselok tani. So it says, we lock the stores privately, we don't work privately, but it's not going to talk about public communal activities. That is different. So now it sounds like prayer might legitimately be a communal activity that is not meant to be done in the context of one's own. Amr of Ashi Rashi says, Matnini Namadaik, and we've also got a Mishnah that seems to indicate this is the point, Diktani, because it will teach, and we'll come to this later. Ma Elu, Yeterot Al Harishonot, what do these have more than the previous ones? One of the last fasts got the other ones don't. Elishveilu Matrin Venon Dechayot, that these ones, we sound the alarm and we lock up the stores. But everything else, they should be the same. And if you say Hachanami Tana Vesha, that in that Mishnah they also left out the detail of prayer. Hama Eluk Tani, it says, what do these? Meaning it asks for a conclusive, comprehensive list. Vitispra Ma Eluk Davkahu, and you think that that is comprehensive as a question? Of course they can lift stuff out. Vahasha Le Teva doesn't mention the ark. Im Shum Teva Lav Shurahu, that's a separate matter. Meshum Dekal Chashav Le Bidach Perka, because that's talked about in the next Perka. This all leads us up to this point, which is now going to conclude the discussion. Hasha Da'atel Achi, now that you've come to this point, that it's reasonable to say there's no difference between these and those fasts and leave out some details that we're going to deal with another time. Esrim V'arba Nami Lav Shiurahu. So don't worry about the 24 either. Tani Lav Bidach Perka, that's going to be taught in another parak. So basically that discussion concludes by saying to us, if you were wondering where on earth all these premises come from, that there's 24 fasts, the ark's involved, we haven't touched on any of this yet. Where's this coming from? The Gemara is basically ending this discussion by saying, yeah, we're going to talk about it another time. Don't worry. Don't take for granted everything we've done so far as being the bottom line on everything. So as we head towards the end of a perek, Chazal are teeing us up that we've not covered everything, there's more to do, and it's going to come up in the next perek. And prayer didn't even get mentioned in this Mishnah when it said, what do we do on these last fast days? We don't wear shoes, we don't eat, we don't drink, we don't anoint ourselves, we lock the stores. So we might think, oh, this is all about behavior, we're done with God, or God is done with us, and we have to move on. So this is a way of Chazal interpolating, what about prayer? Prayer doesn't seem to come up, and back and forth, and then the end is, yeah, that's going to be the next parak. We've got more to do. Okay, my hava Allah, bottom line, we still need to answer the question, when does a person say Anenu in the Amidah? Amr Shmuel by Sistra'i, Rav Shmuel, the son of Sistra'i, said, V'chein Amr Rav Chibar Asher Marav, and so does Rav, Ben Goel Arofe, they follow the view of Rav Yitzchak's father, Rav Asha Mishmeid Rabbanim Rav Yishmol Veshameh Tefillah, and a whole other cluster of sages say, no, you say it privately in Shmeid Tefillah. V'hilchata, bottom line, what is the halakha? An unusual point in a Gemara dialogue. What is the bottom line? Veshameh Tefillah, we say it in the Shmeid Tefillah. So the bottom line conclusion seems to be that an individual always says Anenu inside Shmeid Tefillah. There is no time when individual can consider themselves equivalent of the community. So while this is just a technical liturgical point, it is also a larger point about we can never think that I've got such a crisis in my life that I'm going to say Anenu as a separate bracha now. I'm so enmeshed in my identity with the larger group that I can't treat my own issues as an independent factor, which quashes one's individuality to some degree, and it makes me always think that I'm overreacting if I've got a personal issue because it's not a communal one. And we're going to, again, play with that theme. Now we continue. Tanachada. It was once taught in the green. Ubrot ominikot mitanu b'rishon v'mitanu b'achrona. Those who are pregnant, ominikot, those who are nursing, they fast on the first fast and not on the last fast. Now what are the first and what are the last? if you had to guess at this point.
First.
Oh, interesting. So let's think about only in the context of these fast days to do with rain. We said that there were three, and then three, and then seven. So we said they fast on the first, but not the last ones. At this point, what would you guess? The first three, and not on the last seven. What about the middle three? We don't know yet. Okay, interesting. V'tanya idach, but we've got another teaching that says mitanot ba'achronot, they fast on the last ones, ve'en mitanot ba'rishonot, and they don't fast on the first ones. So if you had to now guess what that meant, they only fast on the last ones and they don't fast on the first ones, what does that Mishnah seem to think they should do? When should they fast? The seven, and when should they not fast? The first. Now we're in trouble. Tanya idach, but we've got another teaching, which is traditional in Jewish context, to have contradictory teachings. En mitanot lo b'rishonot v'lo b'achronot. Another teaching is they don't fast on the last and they don't fast on the first. So where are we left now? We've got three teachings. One says they only fast on the first. One says they only fast on the last. And one says they don't fast on the last or the first. Ah, Amar of Ashi Rasha, there's Nogtabam Siyata B'yadach. Grab the middle one in your hand and that resolves it all. Is that what each one meant? I don't know, and it sounds like the Gemara says I'm not sure, but conceptually it works now. If what they're talking about as the middle point being the starting point of the discussion, the one that says they fast on the first one, not the last one, that means you fast on the middle. One that says you don't fast on the first one, that's talking about the first one, you do fast on the last one, that means the middle one. And the one that says you don't do the first or the last, that leaves the middle one open, so that's where we have. I mean, it's an interesting point where those, presumably those who are pregnant and nursing, they don't have to fast as much because
they're pregnant and nursing,
meaning they're weakened or they're more vulnerable in terms of their health, that we don't want them to take a risk. So conceptually, when would you say maybe they should fast? If you were designing this rhythm and you said, okay, they're a little weakened, the first three, you can eat all night. It's just fasting during the day. And then the second three, this is all day. And the last seven is all day, including the night. So when might I have them fast? I would say you do the first three and don't do the more severe ones. So it's conceptually, it resolves these teachings, have them in the middle. But now we're in a place where we're saying, don't do the first ones, which are easier to do. Don't do the last seven, which are really hard, but do the middle ones. So, I mean, I'll leave that for you. I'm sure we can paint a picture of conceptually why we would say, even though the easiest ones we're saying don't do, but we're saying do the harder ones, why might that be? And it could be that we want you to feel part of the community. We don't want you to feel like you're out, but we're not going to make you do all seven. And we're going to relieve you of the first three, so we don't have to push you too far through the easy ones. We want you to be right in the middle of this with everybody else, and not just kind of have an out. My Elu Yuteret Dar Rishonot, now in the gray, which is picking up on a citation from the Mishnah. How do these middle and last fasts have more than the first? Elu Shebeilu Matrin V'Nan D'Rachayot, that these last ones, we sound the alarm, Matrin, and we lock up the shops. And we're now going to have a discussion of what it means to scream, which some of us may be familiar with. But my matrian, how do we sound the alarm? The Gemara asks. First word in line, matrian. Rabbi Yehuda says, with shofarot, we scream with shofarot. That's how Jews scream. That's how we sound the alarm. Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Shmuel, Rashiel, Mishmei, Rav Amar, he says, ba'anenu. We do it with anenu. Now, this is different to the anenu we've just been discussing. This is anenu that we do often say, probably more often, actually, than the other anenu, although we say it very quickly, usually. So this is the Anenu at the end of Slichot, in the middle of the Tachanun, at the end of Slichot. We say, Anenu Hashem Anenu, Hashem Balakenu Anenu, Anen Biyadenu Anenu. When we get to the end, we're kind of rushing through. And that's actually kind of the crux of the Slichot. And it's been observed that if the congregation is moving quite fast, which is often the case during Slichot, and one needs to skip, which is often the case here or there, we tend to think, oh, I'll skip all the kind of bits at the end. It's in the small print, we kind of rush through that anyway. But Anenu is actually the more ancient part than the Piyutim that were written in the Middle Ages. And it's better to skip some of those Piyutim and do the Anenu at the end than the other way around. So that's just something to bear in mind. And he says, this is kind of the crux. If you're in a taken, right, okay, skip. So this is, which is also, I'll note, this came up this year when you have a Shiva with Slichot or a bridge. During the Shiva, and you don't do the end part. And one might think, oh, that's because it's less significant. We skip it in Shul most of the time anyway. But it's because it's actually the crux of Slichot. In the same way you skip Tachanun in a bait afel, you skip this, because this is kind of a heightened level of desperation, not because it's less significant. So here we have the debate between Rav Yehuda and Rav as to how do I express the most deep, fundamental despondency and despair in the religious vernacular. How do I express despair? One says you have to do it with words. Anenu Hashem, Anenu. What does Anenu mean, literally translated? Answer us. So does that sound like I've given up?
No.
No, I'm asking for an answer. But a shofar is a far more ambiguous thing. Am I shrieking because this is my way of drawing God back? Or this is a primal animal scream that is just, you know, like they have in all the movies when something goes wrong, someone goes, no! Like, just, is that what a shofar is? Or am I still asking for God to get involved? That seems to be somewhere in this debate. Kasaka dachach, and hold on a minute. The Gemara says, hold on. You might think, manda ama ba'aneinu loma v'shofret, that the person who says, oh, what does matriya mean? What do I do on these fast days? And he says, aneinu, you might think they say, and no shofar, just one or the other. These are mutually exclusive. Manda ama v'shofret, and the person who says, with the shofar, loma ba'aneinu, says, you don't do aneinu. These are fundamentally opposed ways of dealing with this emergency. You might think that. V'atani, but it was taught in a brighter, ein pochtim eshevatani yud alesiv, eshevin yud chet hatra'ot. There is a brighter that says, we don't have less than 7 fast days on which there are 18 alarms. The similar davi yuricho, and the way to remember this, the Mishnah says, is yuricho. Now, what happened at Jericho? What did they sound the alarm with?
Shofars.
So presumably, yuricho shofar is shofar at hava. So everybody has to agree there's shofarot involved. Tiyuf to lamanda ba'anenu, and that would dismiss the view of Rav, who said we call that with anenu. Ella. But shofar de chule almelo plige. Everybody agrees that you do sound the shofar on these emergency days. Everybody agrees that that is a verge, that is sounding the alarm when you hit the shofar. Because as we said, shofar is ambiguous. Why do we do the shofar during Elul? What does everyone say we blow the shofar during Elul? What is the point of shofar?
Wake
us up to what?
Tshuva,
to return to God. And there is this other reading of shofar that no, it's just a cry into the wind. And that's why we don't use words. We use an animal horn. It's kind of raw and primal and visceral. And it's not about connecting to God. So you've got those two themes running through the shofar. So he says, you might think they're mutually exclusive. Either shofar means unequivocally, I'm just out and in pain. Or anenu means I'm calling out to God. He says, everybody agrees you sound the shofar. Because the shofar is an ambiguous tool. It can be used as a way to wake us up and get us back on track. Or you're right, it could just be pain in the air, but everyone agrees you sound the shofar. The only debate, ki plige, first word on the line, is plige, second, last, thin line. But anenu, everybody, the whole argument is just whether you say anenu on these emergency fast days, which is again, do I say to God, anenu, answer us, or am I not doing that at this point? Masavi krei lahatra, some people say that is sounding the alarm, and masavi lo krei hatra, and some people say that's not sounding the alarm, that's not what we need to be doing. Lamandama ba anenu, and the person who says, you should say anenu, Rav, of course you sound the shofar. You always sound the shofar. It seems to be in this hierarchy, shofar is less desperate than anenu. It says, if I'm saying you do anenu, of course you do the shofar. But anenu means you are rock bottom. You are just crying out, answer us now. The person who says in this emergency situation you do shofar, but you don't do anenu. It's not that bad, it seems. That seems to be how it's set up. But it was taught in a brayter. If there are other crises, meaning not a drought, not a lack of rain, but other problems, chechu, chagav, zvuv, sira, yutushin, if you got fleas, locusts, flies, shluch nechashim akravim, other wild animals, lo ayim matrimin letzoakim, we told you don't, you are not matria, but you are tzoek. You do cry out, but you don't sound the alarm. So it sounds like here, what is the more desperate thing to do? If we say you are matria, you are not matria, but you are tzoek, sounds like the trua is the more urgent thing. Mitzdaka bepeh, traba shofarot. Since it sounds like tzaka refers to speaking with your mouth, crying out with words, hatra must mean b'shofarot, which seems to prove that hatra means shofar and not anenu. Tanaihi, it's a debate between the early sages. Tanya, as we have here, another case of emergency, al elu matrid b'shabbat. These are the following things where you are matria on Shabbat. And before we get to any of the other details, what would that mean to be matria on Shabbat? What did we say trua might mean? One of two things. It might mean anenu, or it might mean shofar. Do we ever blow the shofar on Shabbat?
No.
No. So the Gemara is going to presume Matriyan b'Shabbat cannot mean anything to do with shofar. So Matriyan must mean something else, even though we just said Matriyan must mean shofar because tzaka is used as the alternative. So now we're going to say, yeah, this is a word that's being used in Chazal in different ways. Some feel it means call out with words, and some think it means with a shofar, which is why in Masechet Rosh Hashanah there's such a debate about what is trua. What sound is that? How does it work? That's why we've got three different sounds. We do it in four different ways. We do it 100 million times because it is an ambiguous term. What does it mean to sound the alarm? So the Mishnah continues, or the Braita. These are the things you cry out for on Shabbat. Al ir shekifua gayes onahar. If a city is surrounded by a army or a river, meaning floods coming. Val sfina matarefa bayam, or if you're on a ship that is being cast around in the ocean. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Rabbi Yossi says, Le Ezra, you can sound the alarm, Le Ezra, for help, of a lola tza'aka, but not just for sheer crying out on Shabbat. Bamai. So that's just the end of the Braita. And the Gemara says, what is this all talking about? Elema b'shofar. If you say Matriya means the shofar, shofar b'shabbat mishari. Who would allow you to blow shofar on Shabbos? Elalav ba'anenu. It must be talking about anenu. V'kari la'hatra, shema minah. So we see, what do we learn from here? Shema minah usually means we've come to a conclusion. What's the conclusion we've come to? It's a debate. That's what we've come to. The Shema Minah, we learn Hatra for some means Aneinu, and for some it means Shofar. So bottom line, what do we do on these public fast days? The Gemara has not reached a conclusion. We're still kind of left in this limbo where there are different practices. Which again is to stress the point, there are occasions where the Gemara will say, Hilchata, what is the bottom line? But that is not the MO of the Gemara. It is not its end ambition to come down, what is the bottom line? Its end ambition is to expound on the Mishnah and make us think through what is the Mishnah touching on thematically, halachically, liturgically. But, I mean, that's why Maimonides in the 12th century said, we need a new code. The Gemara is thematically so disparate. You know, you could be learning Yavamo and think, I know everything there is to know about Yibum, and then you didn't do Ketubot, so you missed a detail that's mentioned there that's not doesn't found anywhere in Masechet Yavamo. He says, so I need to reorganize, I need to put bottom line, I need to make it accessible, memorable, which is obviously casting judgment on what the Talmud is, which made him controversial. So you're trying to replace the Talmud, but it is inescapable that this is not a legal code in the same way that constitutional law would find helpful if you're just looking for bottom line. So, side point. Shnei Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya Havatzara, bottom line in the pink on your dull, we're about to go over the page. In the years of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, there was pain. Sa'ara, there was an emergency. Over to Yudalad Amid Bet in the pink. Gezar Tlat Esrei Ta'ani Lot Vina Ani, he declared 13 fast days, but they were not answered. What do you do now? So we've got the same pattern. Hasn't rained. We've said you have three fast days, then another three, then another seven, which amounts to 13. And then we said, what do you do then? You just stop talking to each other, you stop doing business, you stop celebrating and things like that. Sounds like no more fasts. So Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya had this problem. Doesn't sound like it was rain related. It was just a major catastrophe. And he had 13 fasts. What do you do at this point? Sava l'migza tfe. He thought, well, you know, what's in my quiver? Yeah, what have I got here to do? Let's just do more fasts. I don't know what else to do at this point. Amale Rabbi Ami responded and said, Hari Amru en matrichin et atzibar yota medai. He said, don't drive people crazy. You can't push people to the brink here. Which is, we might read this as a what is called the decline of the generation sometimes, you read out the Dorot, which is basically how we view any public fast days today. You know, when Corona hit, there was a movement in Israel that said we should declare a public fast day. And people said, oh, tircha de tzibar. So they had 13, and then he said, maybe this is too much. We're like, one, you know, let's take it easy. Don't drive people crazy. But again, tircha de tzibar could be read very pragmatically as it's difficult for people to fast, and you keep making them fast, it's going to make their lives miserable. It's not actually going to help. You might view it more broadly as also, this is going to take them to the theological brink. You can't make the new normal that we fast every week because we're in a desperate state. Otherwise, my relationship with God, my new normal is I'm in a desperate position in relation to God, and we can't do that. If you put this tircha into religious life, you will adapt it and kind of contort it in a way that it's not natural anymore. Meaning, if I have to, lahavdil, if I have to come home metaphorically every day and get down on my knees and apologize to Miriam for doing something horrific. And that's what I do every day. That's now our relationship. That's not an emergency anymore. I now have a tircha relationship with my spouse because I spend every day apologizing. And it makes sense that if I do something terrible, I should apologize. But if I do it every day, that changes the relationship forever. So it could be, tircha, you've done 13 fasts, it's not working. And there's a pragmatic concern, it's hard to fast, but you can't change their relationship with God so fundamentally. Either way, that's not going to be the charitable reading that's given in the next line. Am Rab Abba, Breder of Chia Bar Abba. Rab Abba, the son of Rab Chia, the son of Abba, says, hold on a minute. We should do more and more fasts, more and more fasts, and as many as we need. And the fact that Rabbami said we shouldn't, why did Rabbami say we shouldn't fast? If you were being uncharitable towards Rabbi Ami, what would you say his motive was in saying that people shouldn't fast? Say again? He's too old. Be even less generous. Yeah, he's like, I'm hungry. What are you talking about? And essentially, the response is, David legarmehu David. He only said that as public policy because he didn't want to fast anymore. And that's why he said we shouldn't bother the community, which is a harsh reading. Alahachim Reb Chiya bar Abba Reb Yochanan. And this is rather what we should do. Lo shanu ela legshamim. The only time we limit fasts is for rain. And this is again addressing the fundamental question: if we say 13 fasts for rain, then stop. Does that indicate that we have given up? Fasting is going to do nothing else. God has given up on us, and we just need to become hermits and live a life of horror and assume we're all going to hell. Is that what we need to do, give up? That's what it sounds like. And now you're saying, no, 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 the reason we stop at 13 with fast days is not because of that, but because this is the first one line is Bar Abra. Again, Loshanu Lakshami, the only time we stop at 13 is for rain. Ava Lashamine Purnayot, but for other issues, Matan Valtan Archanam Shaman, we keep going until we get answered. We never, ever, ever give up. If something is going wrong, we keep fasting. So we've now got this question. So why do you stop with rain? What is special about rain that we stop after 13 and presume that nothing's going to do anything? Matanya Namahafin, before we go that far, we're going to prove this from an old text, from a brighter, Kashamushava, when we say there's three, and then there's seven, though Amru Elalik Shaman, that's only with rain that there is this set pattern that stops. Avalashamine Pranayot, but with everything else, Matanya Rahokan Ashiyana, we keep going until we get answered. Lemet Yufta Tiyufta de Rab Ami, this sounds like this should be a dismissal of Rab Ami, who said we shouldn't bother people. And the Gemara seems to say, no, our condition, if we are in a state of problem, we should not give up, and we should be desperate, and we should pray, and we should fast, and we should keep going until God responds. D'Tanya, let's just get to the end of the pink. D'Tanya, because it was taught in a brighter last thin line, we don't give more than 13 fasts on the congregation. Rebbe said, because you don't want to drive people crazy. Reb Shuma Gamliel Omer, or Reb Shuma Gamliel Omer, who we follow in this brighter, Lo Min Hashemu, that is not true. We don't stop because we don't want to trouble the community. Why don't we do more than 13 fasts with rain? Because it's not the rainy season anymore. It would no longer, we don't need it anymore. That's the only reason we stop at 13. Not because we've given up, but because it's no longer pertinent. Yeah.
That's really what I was just going to ask. Actually, I didn't see this last line. But I was just wondering globally what the time frame was. Like, when do they start realizing that they don't have, you know, that there hasn't been rain? How much time has to have elapsed to start doing the first set of fasts?
So I don't recall, but we had it a few daf ago, and they said if it hasn't come by Rosh Chodesh Kislev, that's when you start the first fast.
Rashi here says
that. Oh, excellent.
Look at Rashi.
Where? Oh, Shahari Marcheshon Avar Al Kulan Asova Tani Yo. There you go. Excellent. Thank you. So you were thinking
about
Rashi.
Time frame, because if you have it's not 3 days in a row. It's correct. Bet, hey, bet, and then you have again bet, and then I don't know how the seven works.
Weeks
so
have passed.
At the end, you know, if you're doing this whole process, you know, it's over. Rainy season's over. That's
right.
Exactly what I was thinking. So rain, you know, you're finished with that problem.
Right.
Other problems are not time-bound in the same way.
Exactly. Right, meaning if there's an infestation or there's an army, you don't just stop after 13 and say, okay, God's abandoned us, let's just go into our homes and wait for death. We keep fasting, we keep praying, and yeah, that means that there's a new normal. That's what it means, which is something I think we're all struggling with. What does that mean? We just want to go back to things, and we don't want to get used to the new normal. And the Gemara seems to suggest sometimes that's what you need to do. In a crisis, there is a new normal until you can go back. And you keep going. You don't give up and you don't walk away. But then this does beg the question, well, hold on, it's true that the rainy season is limited, but the particular dates of that rainy season presumably depend on where you're living. Anyone ever been to Australia here? Anyone ever been to New Zealand, Australia? Anyone ever left the country? No one's ever left the country? Right, you've left the country, good. Anyone been to the Southern Hemisphere? Yes, like South Africa, or South America, I mean? Right, so I don't know what they do liturgically in these places where right now they're in the middle of summer. And in the winter, in the summer they're in the middle of winter. I don't know. But in terms of, do they say V'tein Talam Matar in Berachat Hashanim when they need rain? Mashiv HaRuah.
Is it Israel?
That's what we tend to assume. So that's my assumption there as well, that, you know, here we might... You know, we're saying Mashiv Ruach Geshem in the middle of a storm. I mean, you do that in Israel too. If it's raining, you still say Mashiv Ruach Geshem. But we presume it's all about Israel. And in many ways, that response is the conclusion of this passage here. But it's being entertained for a moment. If this is about me, and this comes back to that theme, can I have a personal crisis, or am I only allowed to define my crises in relation to us as a people? You know, when people always say, is it good for the Jews? You know, that's how I should look at my world. Is it good for us? Is it good for us as a species or us as a people? But to think, well, is it good for me? That shouldn't be in our religious vocabulary. Is that where it should be? Or can I think about what I need? Shalchu le b'nei Ninveh l'Rebbe. So the occupants, third line in the yellow, the occupants of Ninveh sent a note to Rebbe and said, Kagon Anan, what about us living in Ninveh? Da afilu b'tkuvat tamuz b'inan mitra, that even in the middle of the summer, we need rain. So it's not like Israel, by the time Pesach come along, we've given up. See, we've just said we stop after 13 fasts because rain is no longer wanted. So the Ninevites say, well, hold on, we still want rain, so should we keep praying? Are we like, Heichinavid, what should we do? Fourth line, Kechidim Daminon or Karabi Daminon? Are we like individuals, even though we're together here as a community? Can there be such a thing as a diaspora community with our own identity? Or we're just islands out here? And this is how... I remember Rav Lichtenstein once describing what living in the diaspora should feel like, you know, as opposed to living in Israel. In Israel, he described that everywhere you go, you feel like you're at home. Every step you take, you're stepping on home and you feel comfortable. In the diaspora, one should feel like we live on islands, that we have a shul that we feel at home in, we have our homes we feel at home in, we have our friends' homes, but as we walk in the street from place to place, we should feel like we're on foreign soil or foreign territory. I'm not saying that that's how everybody should see life. I just remember him speaking that way.
In terms of praying for rain, in, like, you know, what Sam was saying, in terms of, you know, that we're really praying for Eretz Yisrael. Because isn't theologically the concept of things growing based on rain, you know, like the connection between our prayer and rain and our behavior and rain, only the concept in Israel? Wasn't that the concept of why B'nai Israel were concerned about, you know, what is it, chinam, you know, coming into Eretz Israel, that now suddenly they have to earn?
Right.
You know.
And the Gemara entertains this earlier on, where it says, in Baval, we don't really rely on rain. So it doesn't, none of this really applies to us, because we've got irrigation, we're low-lying, and everything comes here. But Nineveh presumably is a little higher, and they did depend on rain even later in the year. But that's essentially what's at play here. Do we only care about Israel? And it's true that we'd be suffering and we might need it, but if we need it, do we say it in Shomer Tefillah? This comes back to that earlier question, or can we say it in Birchat Hashanah? Is this a communal problem? And the conclusion it's going to have is, Ki yechidim d'minim Shomer Tefillah, are we like individuals? Even though there are thousands of us living in Nineveh, we've got every member of the JCC of Nineveh is in trouble. Do we have a communal fast day? Or do we say, we're all in trouble, but out here, we're all individuals? I'm not. That's from Life of Brian. Oh, karabim d'minim Birchat Hashanah. Or we like a community here, and that we should have it in Birchat Hashanah. Shlach lehu, it was sent back to them, meaning the Israel authorities, or whoever they sent to, wrote back to them and said, out in Nineveh, it doesn't matter how many of you are in trouble, ki yechidim d'mitu, v'shmei tefillah, you are like individuals out there, and you should do this prayer for rain in shmei tefillah. And this is what I meant, I'm not sure, in places in the world where they need rain in the middle of the summer, I think there are responsa literature that says they should say v'tein talam matar in shmei tefillah, at a time of year when they need rain where they are. So it could be if you're in Australia in August, you're saying the Tein Talam Matar, but in Shomer Tefillah. because it's something that you need there. Mashiv Aruch Medageshim is seen as tied to Israel. But Ten Telemata might be broader, and they might have to say it on their own. Even though there are thousands of them who need rain, you're all individuals out here. You may have shuls, you may have communities, but this is not a communal problem because everything is drawn back to the land of Israel. That's the assumption here. In Nineveh?
Yeah, that could have. I mean, the answer might have been different if it was coming from within.
Right.
Not from.
So it could be either they didn't have, and politically the authority was more centralized, or it could be that this was their bid to connect, and the Talmidei Chachamim said, we know how we feel about it, but how do you feel about it? And there's deference here. So if you want to do a reflection on Zionism, this is a good passage to think about. Meitfei, we have a brayta that pushes back to suggest, hold on a minute, in Shomer Tefillah, for diaspora communities, that doesn't seem to be the case in this brayta. And what we'll see in a minute, as Debbie says, you're going to get a different answer if you have a diaspora figure respond, maybe. So, Mishnah, Amar Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda said, Eimatai, when does this all apply? All these things about if you're in the diaspora, you do it in Shomer Tefillah. Bizman Shashanim Ketiknan, that is when things are normal. The Israel Shirin Al Admatan, and Israel is an independent state in the land of Israel. Aval bizman azeh, but nowadays, hakol lefi yashanim, everything depends on what the year is like. Hakol lefi mekamot, everything depends on where you're living. Hakol lefi azman, everything depends on the time. Meaning, it's true, when we have a state of Israel, and we have a collective position, and we've got outposts in the world where there are Jewish communities and towns in different places, everything is defined by the Jewish state. That's a communal problem. It's not a national crisis if something's going wrong somewhere else. But in our world, Rabbi Yehuda says, we don't have a state. We don't have a centralized place. There are communal problems that break out all over the place, and we're not tied together in that way. So it sounds like the Sholech Lehu, whoever sent that response, was wrong. Amale, and the response is, Matnita Ramit Ale de Rebbe, you're going to use a Mishnah to say that Rebbe was wrong? Rebbe Tanahu, a Palig. Rebbe, so again, we've got a bottom line conclusion. It's a debate. Omai hava Allah, but now we need, we need an answer, the Gemara says. What do we learn about this? Reb Nachman Amar Bechad Hashanim. And what we have bottom line is, there's still a debate, but we're going to have to pick a side. Reb Nachman Amar Bechad Hashanim. Reb Nachman said, diaspora communities should have communal crises that they can deal with as a community. Rav Sheshet Amar, Rav Sheshet Tzitzpah, Shmei Tzfilah, no. If you're in the diaspora, it is a private problem. V'hilchata, bottom line, how do the Babylonian Talmud conclude if there's a diaspora crisis? Is that a communal crisis or not? Bottom line, Hilda b'shomer tefillah, no, it's a private crisis. Everything is defined by the Jewish state, the Jewish center of national life. And so the conclusion there does seem to be a very strong, I don't know if Zionist is the right term, it's anachronistic, but push that Jewish life is oriented around the land of Israel and Jewish life in Israel, even if there's more in the diaspora, there's a crisis there. You said in Shomer Tefillah, we should not think ever that we're at the center of the Jewish world unless we're in the land of Israel. That's how this passage seems to conclude, which could be read purely as a Zionistic observation. It could also be read very differently. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks has a long piece about Jewish solidarity that makes this sound, not this piece in particular, but generally somewhat more complicated. But we'll leave that for another time. New question. We've got some technical questions now as we head into the home straight. I think that's what it's called. On Mondays, on these last fast days, we close the stores at... Matim means we open them a little bit, with dark. And on Thursday, we have it all day because of the honor of Shabbat. So now I'm going to ask you what this means. It says we should have the doors open to the store a little bit on Mondays, towards dark, and on Thursdays all day long. So what are we doing on Thursdays all day long? Right, so we're not sure, is it, whatever we're doing on Monday a little bit, we're doing a little bit but all day on Thursday, or on Thursday the doors are completely open? That there's a little ambiguity. So they ask, this is what it teaches. What is it teaching? It's saying you should open the doors a little bit on Monday with dusk, but on Thursday you have it open a little bit all day long. But maybe a little bit on Monday, but on Thursday the doors are wide open. Tashma, come and learn. We've got a teaching. The Tanya, it was taught, on Monday it's open a little bit until night. But on Thursday, it is open all the way, all day long. It is true, even in a time of crisis, There is Shabbat, there is built in. So even though there is this new normal, where if there's a crisis mode, you don't give up, you keep fasting, you keep praying, you keep feeling like you're in trouble, we do have an inbuilt system to make sure that that new normal doesn't define us. There is a Shabbat every week, and the doors to the stores are open, and you keep going like it's regular, which people often reflect when there are, God forbid, terror assaults in Israel, and the news crews are always surprised that there's like a suicide bomb, and then like an hour later, the street's going again, and people are back in stores. How do you live with such trauma and just bounce back? And to some degree, Chazal is saying that's what has to be in order to survive, not in that particular instance, but reflected of that spirit. Yes, there is a new normal. We live in Israel at times of terror. You're living in a world in constant fear. You're running to bomb shelters. You go to pizza stores with your heart rate up all the time. But you have to keep going. You have to say, I can't assume that I'm now just traumatized all day. I have to try and find ways to make this normal. And Shabbat is the inbuilt mechanic for, even though we're in a state of pain as a community, we don't have rain, we don't have food, we feel abandoned, Shabbat comes and we put on our Shabbos clothes and we sing Shalom Aleichem and we make Kiddush and we sit at the table and we thank God and we sing Zmirot and we feel God in our lives. So Shabbat is that pocket built in, and Thursday leads us up for that. It does say, "Halo shnei petachim." If you have two doors to your store, potechecha v'nolachad, you should leave one open and close one. You should still indicate to some degree that this is a difficult time. Hayalo estba keneged pilcho. But if you've got, think of a store like Hotspot. I know other places have this. A lot of restaurants have this, where they've got this little built thing on the outside. You open one door, and there's just like a windshield for everybody inside, and there's another door. So if you've got an istba, like a board that blocks inside, just don't leave the door open, don't worry about it. And to some degree, some have read this as, why don't you just open all the doors if it's for Shabbos? Because it's still a fast day and you don't want people to feel hungry looking at all the food. I don't know if it's just me. Every time there's a fast day, all the ads on TV seem to be about food. I don't know if it's just me. But the assumption is if people see food, it's difficult, so you don't want them to do that. But if you've got an itztavah blocking it, you save people from doing that. If none of these fasts get answered, we're now in emergency mode, we're out of fast, we've done the 13, the rainy season has come to an end, what do we do at this point? We said you don't do, you have to limit masa umatan, business, and you limit building, binyan, and you limit planting. Tana, it was taught, babinyan, babinyan shal simcha, netin tiyu shal simcha. It doesn't mean you should stop building, you still got to, you know, if your business is construction, you don't stop building because you're in a crisis. You need to make a living still. So it says, no. We're talking about you shouldn't do building of joy and you shouldn't do planting of joy. Now, what is building of joy and planting of joy? Ezu binyan shel simcha. What is building of joy? This is someone who builds a wedding house for their child. What is a wedding house? If you had to guess, what is a beit chatnut? I mean, it sounds almost, and some have read it, Rashi actually sounds like this means you shouldn't do weddings, you shouldn't build a chuppah. But many have not read it that way. So, no, of course, you still need to do weddings. Life has to continue. But it just means often a couple, when they get married, will go to a different hotel that night, or they'll go to a special place that's made for grooms and brides to spend the opening days of their marriage. And the suggestion is people would do this in the old world. They'd say, you got married, here's a special beit chanut for you to stay in. And we don't do that. Meaning, go back to your apartment, go back to your home. You know, we're not doing this excessive, aesthetic, luxurious building. Of course, you've got to get married, you've got to keep going, but we don't go over the top. That's how many have read Beit Chatnut. Eidu nitiya shesimcha. And what is planting of joy? Zenotea avak de shalom alachim. This is when one engages in building these, what is a trellis? Is trellis the right word?
Trellis.
Great. So trellises of kings. Now, what is that about? It used to be, there are different readings here. One reading is, when a king was born, they used to plant a tree the same day, and then when that king would be coronated, or crowned, as I'm told, often coronated is in the word, they would use the wood from that tree to make the throne. The Gemara in Gittin talks about a practice that some towns used to have. When any child was born, they would plant a tree, and then they would use the wood from that tree to weave the chuppah for the bride and groom from those two trees. A touching, you know, when I was born, actually, my parents did get a tree, an apple tree that they planted in the ground. And when I got married, I like had this thing. I was like, oh, it would be really nice if we could like take a branch of it or something and maybe put it in the chuppahs. You know, when you're getting married, you get excited about small things that really aren't that important. And my parents, they were open to the idea. And then someone said, well, importing wood from the European Union might be illegal. So I just said, oh, forget it. We'll be fine. I'll tell it someday in a Dafa Shavuot and we'll live with it. So that was the end of that. But that's one vision of what it means, luxurious planting, meaning you can still get married without it, but it's a nice thought. Another reading is the trellises of kings means that the royal gardens would often have these luxuriant gardens that you'd go for walks in, but doesn't really serve a practical purpose other than they're pretty. And we don't do that either. Shalom, shalom. What about addressing each other? Say we don't talk. I'm sorry, we may have to not do it all the way to the end, or we're going to rush through. Shalom. What about talking to each other? Tanur Rabban and the rabbis taught, said, hold on, we limit talking to each other? No fast, no rain this year. We don't talk to each other anymore? This sounds like grief. This sounds like we've given up. This sounds like I'm not talking to anybody. I'm becoming a hermit. Chaverim, people who are chaverim, which means a educated group of Jews, ein sholin shelot shalom b'neim. They shouldn't talk to each other. Amei ha'aretz, but people who are not fluent in Jewish law, shalin, they may address him and say, good morning, how are you? And this often comes up around Tisha B'Av. We say, you shouldn't address people on Tisha B'Av. What if someone comes up to you and says, good morning? Hit him in the face. Like, how do you respond to someone saying, good morning to you? You're not meant to respond. I would not recommend hitting him in the face. Machzirin lehem b'safa rafa, you should respond in a low tone of a koridroshan with like, someone says, good morning. You just say, good morning. And I mean, that could also lead to like, oh, are you okay? And then you just don't want to get into it. So my reason is just say good morning and move on. But that's how you should respond in this context. Vehemet adfin, and then it adds on. Again, this might sound like we're in grief. We've given up. We're not talking to each other. But this is a community of isolated mourners where we are in this together for a reason. What is the reason? Hemet adfin, they wrap themselves up. Vyoshvin ka'avelin, they sit like mourners. They come nudin, like people who have been excommunicated. Kibnei Adam, hanaz nufim ibnei amakom, like people who have been objected to by God. Until what? Archi rachmu alehim and ashmaim, until God responds. Every one of these rituals, every one of these gestures has the ambition of God coming back. We are not giving up. So that point that sounded like we've given up, we stopped fasting, is really just because the season is over. But we find other ways to try and get God to have mercy on us. We don't need rain, we just still need God. Amar Belazar, and this is going to lead us to the end of the prayer. Belazar says, and this comes to a point, I'm sure many of you have heard this joke, when the rabbi gets up before the Aaron and says, God, I'm a nothing. God, please answer me. I'm a nothing. Then the chazan comes and says, God, I'm a nothing. Home, please, I'm a nothing. The president comes up and says, God, I'm a nothing. Please answer me. I'm nothing. And then someone walks in and says, oh, this is what we do. Gets up and says, God, I'm a nothing. And the rabbi looks up and says, look who thinks they're a nothing. I mean, I'm sure you've heard that joke. And to some degree, that's what's going to be reflected on in the coming lines, which is, well, who gets to pray? How do we get to pray? When does it look stupid? And when does it look like a farce? If I stand up and I pray and I say, God, please answer us. And then everyone's looking around and the rabbi just got up and had this whole prayer. I'm sure we've heard about, Rosh Hashanah prayer that we all love and can't imagine ever skipping.
Or forgetting.
Netana Togef, thank you. How did Netana Togef start? Amnon, this is the story of Amnon, who was made by Bishop to go and speak to him, and he had his hands chopped off, and he came before the shul, and in his last breath, he stood before the Aaron, and he said, Netana Togef, very moving legend. We can talk another time about the history of that legend, but that's the story. One is if I came into a shul one day on a Shabbat, and I said, there's an emergency. Something terrible is happening. I'm going to stand before the Aaron Kodesh. I'm going to rip my clothes and I'm going to shriek, help us, God, I need your response right now when I count to three. I need something. One, two, three. Anyway, Musaf can be found. I mean, like that's a strange thing to do. So at what point, if prayer is about sincerely reaching out to God, when does it look ridiculous? If we're all now not talking to each other and we're all fasting and we're all shutting down our businesses, at what point does that look ridiculous? Like, no, God's not going to respond. You're just looking silly. And what point do we draw the line? And that's what's going to come now. Amar Rabbi Elazar says, Ein Adam Chashev, an important person, is not permitted, Lipol al Panav, to fall down on their face and pray to God, Elim Kenanak Yoshua ben Nun, unless they know that they're going to be answered like Joshua the son of Nun, meaning Yeshua. How many important people can be guaranteed that they know they're going to be answered like Yoshua ben Nun? Probably none, I would imagine. And if they think they can, they're probably not one of those people. Right? So Paul and Pilate is not allowed to get down on the face like it should have been. And Shneimar, this is V'yamashem L'Yoshua, because God said only to Yoshua, Kum lach, up you get from the floor. Lamazad and Ofer Panach, you don't need to get down on the floor. Only Yoshua was told by God, that works. Amr Abulazah, Enam Chashav HaSholach Korsak. And Rabbi Elazar says, and an important person is not allowed to wear sackcloth. Elim Kenan HaKayurim Ben Achav. Unless they know they're going to be answered, like the instant when Yoram Ben Achav was answered. In Tanakh, Shneimar, Zitzit, Yishmo, Melech, Divrei Yeshua, when he heard the words of the prophetess, we pray about Gaddafi, he tore his clothes, Vorov Elachom, and he was walking around on the wall of the city of Yara, Amin, Ayasak, Abbasavar, and the people saw that he was clothed in sackcloth. And he wasn't one of the most pious kings, but he had a moment of reflection, and God answered him when he dressed in sackcloth. Now, if I came to shul wearing sackcloth, or I came to shul and every day I got down on the floor, people start thinking the rabbi's lost his marbles, or he just looks ridiculous, and that's not actually helpful. And here's the thing, an important person who draws communal attention can't do these extreme measures, because if you don't get responded to, it mocks you, it mocks prayer, it makes religion look like a farce, and you need to find a balance so you don't draw too much attention to the emergency situation you're in, because you have to have the humility that maybe God won't respond. And that's built in to this discussion. Not everybody is going to get responded to if they tear their clothes. Not everybody is going to get responded to if they fall down on the ground. Moshe Aaron and Nefila, Moshe and Aaron were answered by falling on the ground. Yeshua and Caleb were answered with tearing. Moshe Aaron and Nefila, we have a positive. They were answered with falling, as it says in the verse in Bamidbar. Yeshua and Caleb and Yeshua and Caleb were answered with tearing. It says in the next passage, Yeshua and Caleb and Yeshua and Caleb were them, they ripped their clothes. It only said, Moshe and Aaron did this, Yeshua and Caleb did that. Yes, I would agree they're separate practices. But it says, Moshe and Aaron did this, V'Yeshua and Yeshua. It sounds like Yeshua did both. He both got down on the ground and tore his clothes. So they're both included. Amar Belaz, Belaz says, and this is where we suddenly have this pivot. Having spoken about, we're getting into the last lines of the Perek now. We had everything's fallen apart. We've had no rain. We've fasted three times. We've fasted three more times. We've fasted seven times. We've stopped talking to each other. We've stopped doing business. We've stopped planting gardens. We're no longer in a place. We are in what is sometimes called austerity in political terms. We're in a major crisis. And we've now said, and not only in this crisis, not only have you been bereft of God in your lives, but we've now been stripped of the ability to express that bereavement because it might look silly. We now say, don't go too extreme in your bid to have God back in your life, because people will look at you and they will mock you, and that will undermine the bereavement. So we're now in a really difficult tension where we're in despair, and we're told, and careful how you display that despair. So what the Chazal do, and they do this at the end of almost every Masechta, and it happens often at the end of a Perek as well, which is, if you end here, it's like, oh, okay, I'm happy, have a good day. You know. So there's now a pivot and says, but don't worry. There will be a time when we should have hope, and we can always have hope. Even if you're in despair, we have to keep going through, and that end, this is what we're hoping for. Amr Abulazar, Abulazar says, oh, on the subject of not everybody has the same behaviors, and it works, lo akol b'kima, not everybody does standing up, lo akol mishtachavai, not everybody does bowing. What is bowing and standing up? And we're meant to be thinking, oh, we're talking about desperation, we're talking about getting down and ripping clothes, and now we're going to have a pivot and say, no, we're talking about the end of days, when the peoples of the world will come to the Jews and apologize. Anyone who's seen The Lord of the Rings, you've got this, I don't know, how many of you have seen Lord of the Rings? Not many, so I won't use that as a good example then. But if you've had this life of despair, and then you have this kind of pathos at the end, where everybody comes to you and recognizes that really you're the hero, and really you've been mistreated, and this has been a horrific journey, and now you can breathe and relax, and everybody comes to you, some people are going to bow, some people are going to stand, and this is where we are. Malachim b'kima. The kings of the world will stand before the Jews. Sarim ishtachavaya, and the officers of the world will bow down to the Jews. So there will be different responses to Jews in that day. To Malachim b'kima, how do we know the kings will stand? It says, Kol ma Hashem kol Yisrael k'tiyosho. God will say, onto the Tet Vav Amad Aleph, Livzo nefesh, to those who have been abandoned, the Mitav Goy, to those who have been debased by the nations in the world, the Evan Moshlim, to those who have been servants of others. Melachim Yiru V'kamu, the kings will see and they will stand up. So we've now been told, Chazal are guaranteeing to the readers of their legacy. There is always hope. And we've been reflecting a lot on the prophetic warnings of despair. But the prophets also promise a good end. That the kings will come and stand before you. V'sarim b'shachavaya, and the officers of the world, who've been following orders and being horrific, They will bow down to you. The chetivet says, "Sarim shtachavu," that the princes will bow down. Magav Rabzer Rabzer Zutmer Rishu Ben Achmani holding them in Evav Ktivi Yishtawi Evuda said, "Vesarim," and the princes bow down. Kedamar, I would agree. They only do one. Hashad Ktiv Sarim Shtachavu. Now that it says princes and they will bow down, Havavad, it sounds like they stand and bow down. Okay, we could spend time on that. We're not going to. Last four lines. Avram Nechma Yitzchak, Nachma Yitzchak said, and since we've done a lot of talk on the two themes we're now going to weave together, two themes were, should I ever give up? And can I ever think about myself as an individual and not just part of the community? And so far we've had a huge thrust saying, no, you are only part of a community. Any private crisis, even if it's a communal crisis in the diaspora, you are saying that in Shomei Tefillah like this is a personal matter. Nothing amounts in your life to what amounts to communal crisis, and you should never give up hope. So we've now resolved there should always be hope. The kings of the world will bow down and stand before us. Can I ever be myself? Amr ibn Nachman Yitzchak says in the last four lines, Afani Omer, let me add. And perhaps we could say Afani Omer is not just an I say, but the I in us all say, what about me as an individual? Lo hakol laora. Not everybody will lead to earning and having the worthiness of light. Lo hakol simcha. Not everybody will earn joy at the end of days. Tzadikim la'ora, those who are righteous will have or, isharim la'simcha, and those who are upright will have joy. There's a huge debate among the commentators, what's better, light or joy? What's better to be a tzadik or a yosher? Tzadikim la'ora, how do I know that tzadikim will have joy? Dechtiv, it says, or zaro la'tzadik, or isharim simcha, and how do I know the upright will have joy? Dechtiv, l'ishrei la'simcha, that those who are upright of heart will have joy. Hadran alach me'ematai, we have finished the first perek, nobody thought we would, we did. Oh my gosh, I'm sorry for the time. Next week, as I say, I apologize. I'm not going to be able to be here, but we will continue with Tet Vav the next time, and we will plow ahead, and I will try to time this so that we can be done by Pesach, so that we can maybe do the Siyum of Tanit B'Chorot on Tanit, and then take a break until we do Dav HaShavua with a new Masechet. I wish you all a wonderful day.